Middle of a series at the moment on the book of Amos in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, and we're kind of working our way through that. We have some material as well accompanying the series, so if you haven't got a copy of that yet, please do pick a copy up in the lobby outside on the table there. And it's just got discussion questions that kind of match the message each week. So we're on week three now, so there's a bunch of questions and activities there. Ideal to go through in groups. So we have a bunch of groups that meet during the week. Some meet after the service today, some meet during the week in homes. And if you would like to be in a group and you're not in a group yet, also would love to get you in a group and help you get connected there. So you could sign up and give us your details at the same place you can get the material, and we'll get you connected. So the cover is a lion, right? And we talked last week about the first section. We really looked at most of the first three chapters of Amos. And we noted how that section began with a reference to a lion, of a metaphor of God roaring, and it ended with a reference to a lion. And that's kind of the way this book is divided up. It's divided up into these three chunks through these sort of bookends of a metaphor at the beginning mirrored by a metaphor at the end. And the lion is significant, I think, because there's this sense, the theme of the book of Amos is about injustice in society. And there's this sense of kind of, I guess, anger and unfairness, and the roaring God, God roaring like a lion, is because God really cares about this. And there's also this sense of strength. On the one hand, intimidation, but also a sense of strength of it's going to take a lot of courage to change, a lot of courage to bring change. So I think the lion is significant. Now, last week, as I said, we looked at that section where it's bounded by the lion metaphors, but it also includes these accusations against various nations that surround Israel. You may remember we had a map last week we were looking at. We had a handout of that. And we saw how Amos kind of accuses all the nations around Israel of injustice. And he's setting a trap for Israel because they feel very proud and like they're an elite nation. They're God's chosen people. They're very strong. They're very comfortable. And so they've also been at war and had lots of strife with these other nations. So they see the accusation against the other nations and they're cheering Amos on. That's great. Yeah, they're unfair. They committed these atrocities against us and other people. But then he basically sets a trap by having them, the people of Israel, agree with his condemnation of other nations and nation states. They therefore condemn themselves because they are guilty of exactly the same things, if not even worse things. Now, the next section begins with another kind of two bookends, what we call an inclusio, where he talks at the beginning of this next section about foreign nations again, and closes it off with a reference to a foreign nation. Let's just look at those first two chunks, okay? So this will bound the section that we're going to look at today from middle of chapter 3 through to the end of chapter 6. So if we can look at the first one, I think it's 3 verse 14. Okay, so here's what he's saying. Proclaim to the fortresses of Ashdod and to the fortresses of Egypt. Assemble yourselves on the mountains of Samaria. See the great unrest within her and the oppression among her people. They do not know how to do right, declares the Lord, who hoard, plunder, and loot in their fortresses. Let's just keep that one up there for a moment. Okay, so proclaim to the fortresses of Ashdod. Ashdod is a city in Philistia. Okay, the Philistines, or the Philistines, whichever way you pronounce that, were an arch enemy of the people of Israel, right? There's lots of stories about the Philistines in the Hebrew Scriptures. Egypt is a nation that had enslaved the people of Israel. Okay, so what is happening here is having sort of talked to all these different nation states at the beginning of the section, he's now gathering those nation states. He's gathering the traditional enemies of Israel to come to Mount Samaria, or the mountains of Samaria, the capital of Israel, and kind of watch while they get judged. And he's saying, he's judging them based on the same criteria. So this would have been so humiliating for the people of Israel. So think of it, they viewed themselves as the chosen nation, the elite of the religious world, if you like. They viewed themselves very proudly, and now their enemies are being gathered around to watch while they get punished, basically, while they get judged. It's humiliating. Let's jump to the end of this section. So we're going to go now to the end of chapter 6. And there's another reference to foreign nations, okay? So he says, therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says. An enemy will overrun the land. He will pull down your strongholds and plunder your fortresses. So lots of plundering and fortresses falling down and all the rest of it. We talked last week about the fact that these accusations, this judgment is not against, it's not indiscriminate. It's against power bases. It's against fortresses. It's against military might, economic might. It's against religious might. Okay, it's against the powers, not against the people. But the people are implicated in the powers, right? But this is good news if you are oppressed. It's good news if you're poor. It's not so good news if you're part of a system that is causing oppression. So these two bookends enclose the passage that we're going to look at this week. And so the theme, one of the themes running through is this whole idea of other nations being used by God to judge the people of Israel. And we have to ask ourselves the question, well, what's going on there? Why is Amos using this theme? Why is he using these metaphors? And one of the reasons is, because, or perhaps the main reason, is because one of the main accusations that Amos has for the people of Israel is their arrogance and complacency. Okay, this is humiliating for them. He's pointing to some humiliating things, foreign nations, judging them. And the reason he's doing that is because they are being they've become so proud and arrogant. Arrogant in their religion, arrogant in their military might, arrogant in their economic might. And that has blinded them to what's really going on in their culture. So the themes we're going to explore this week, and they're not the only themes in this section, but the themes we're going to explore are the way in which wealth and comfort and the pursuit of those things can, doesn't have to, but can blind us and desensitize us, almost anesthetize us to what's real about the world and certainly what's the need in the world. And secondly, the way in which religion can, left to its own devices, become an empty, meaningless thing. Just empty, pathetic religious rituals that have no meaning and they're totally separate from a connection to God that means we're also connected to human beings. Amos calls people back to an intimate connection to God that not only sensitizes us to spiritual things, but sensitizes us to the people around us. So we are awakened with compassion to people around us, and we treat people well. And he's pointing to things in the society of Israel at that time to say, that's not happening. Okay, so we're going to explore these themes of empty religion and complacence and arrogance. So complacency and arrogance. So let's look at some scriptures that deal with this issue of complacency first. If we go to chapter 6, okay, that's the second part of the, what I was saying there. Yeah, okay, so if we go to chapter 6, here's what, actually, I think isn't there one in verse 1 that goes 1 to 7? Chapter 6, verse 1 to 7, is that one up there? Yeah, okay. So, lots of woes in this section, okay? Woe to you. You know, it's, as you may remember, we said on week one that this section of the book is called the Book of Woes. The first section was called the Book of Doom. So, you know, it's kind of a little bit downbeat, but it gets better towards the end. Woe to you who are complacent in Zion, and you who feel secure on Mount Samaria, you notable men of the foremost nation to whom the people of Israel come. Go to Calneh and look at it. Go from there to Great Hamath, then go down to Gath in Philistia. He's referencing the Philistines again. And are they better off than you, your two kingdoms? Is their land larger than yours? You put off the evil day and bring near a reign of terror. You lie on beds inlaid with ivory and lounge on your couches. You dine on choice lambs and fattened calves. You strum away on your harps like David and improvise on musical instruments. You drink wine by the bowlful and use the finest lotions, but you do not grieve over the ruin of Joseph. That's a reference to Israel. Therefore, you will be among the first to go into exile. Your feasting and lounging will end. Now, let's also look at that next verse there, verse 8, which follows right on from that. The sovereign Lord has sworn by himself. The Lord God Almighty declares, I abhor the pride of Jacob. Another word for Israel. I abhor the pride of Jacob and detest his fortresses. I will deliver up the city and everything in it. Okay, so that's the opening section to chapter 6, where he's basically pinpointing where the complacency is, where the arrogance is. And I can see at least three themes there, three trains of arrogance. One is religious. Okay, there's religious references there. Clearly, I mean, I think the strumming on the harps like David is a religious reference. They're kind of loving their religion. They think they're the greatest. They think they've got the best religion. They're better than everybody else. And they're perhaps reading into a lot of their wealth and comfort that, oh, God must love us. and you know, and they're very comfortable in their religion. There's also economic comfort there, right? Lots of fattened calves and lotions and wine and all the rest of it. Nothing wrong with any of those things in and of themselves. But this is to excess, and they're like just living it up. And we know that the implication is that there are some people, many people in fact, who are not living it up. Like the people living it up have control over systems that mean they can maintain their wealth and they can keep this healthy, this wealthy lifestyle at the expense of other people. Okay, so there's religious complacency, there's economic complacency. Hey, we're comfortable, life's great. And then at the end there, we saw there's also military complacency. In other words, we're safe, we're secure, we're a strong country. We have a good military base. Our fortresses are okay. We're blessed. We're great. It's great to be an Israelite at this time in the 8th century BCE. And they have a lot of reasons to think that life's fine and life's okay. But in the culture, in the society, maybe hidden away from some people, maybe blatantly obvious to others, is this injustice. There's poor. There's people crying out. There's people being mistreated. And God's saying, you can't be blind any longer. You can't be complacent any longer. You have to listen to the cry of the poor. You have to listen to the cry of the oppressed. Okay, so we have this complacency sort of deep-seated in the culture of the people of Israel. Now, that complacency seems to be the very thing that has driven God out. Like, the people are not open to God. They're not open to the divine. They're really saying, like, the divine is something I use. The religion is something I use to make myself feel better, to kind of support and justify the lifestyle I live. It's something that I'm, they're not necessarily admitting this, but it's something that's being manipulated, according to Amos anyway, to keep them in power, to keep them sort of sanctioning and making it all okay to have the kind of culture that they have, rather than it being a religion that has an openness to God through which they are then aware of what's going around them and they are moved with compassion and they're willing to give up control and not just think about themselves but think about other people. So the remedy for this, the way in which Amos challenges them to change is rather than pride and complacency pushing God out, he challenges them to let God in. He gives them this challenge to seek God. So if we look at chapter 5, there's lots of references in chapter 5 to seek God. We're going to go there in a second. But first of all, also in chapter 5 is this phrase, the day of the Lord. Okay, so woe to you, another woe. Woe to you who long for the day of the Lord. Why do you long for the day of the Lord? That day will be darkness, not light. Now this is a really important point in the whole of Amos. It's kind of, in some ways it seems a minor issue, but the day of the Lord is a very significant term in Hebrew culture. Okay, if you read the Hebrew scriptures, there's lots of references to the day of the Lord. And it became known as this day when all Israel's enemies would be vanquished, right? So it's some day in the future where Israel would finally be restored to full glory, to the golden age of King David, to the days where there would be days of great prosperity and peace and success. And the people or certain parts of the Hebrew culture saw that as God kind of destroying their enemies. The day of the Lord would be the day when the people who are against us get their comeuppance. Now, all religions have that, right? I mean, Christianity, we ourselves might have this kind of view that one day the people who criticize us, the people who are kind of against us, the people who disagree with us, they're going to get their comeuppance one day. And there's something in the human heart, I think, that wants to think that people won't get away with what they seem to get away with in this life. So we're kind of secretly kind of glad about judgment, or can be. And I think that's what was going on in the people of Israel. They were like, our enemies will be defeated. They'll find out what the truth is one day. And this is inherent in most religion. If you think about the people in the Islamic religion who just go out and kill people, cut people's heads off and blow people up, they're of the belief that we are right and everybody else is wrong, and God will vanquish us. God will avenge us one day. They'll know that we're right, and we're kind of bringing that day on now. And it's the same thing when Christians stand at funerals with placards that say God hates fags. I mean, that despicable kind of judgmental attitude towards other people, which is like, I'm right, you're wrong, and actually God's going to judge you eventually, right? So religions have this inherent judgmental element to them that we have to be really careful about. And so he's challenging them and saying, don't long for the day of the Lord. Don't long for judgment, because you know what's going to happen? If judgment comes, if it's judgment's what you want, you're the one's going to get judged. Because the prophets, and Amos was the first prophet to really kind of explore this theme, the prophets had a very different view about the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord was not a day when Israel's enemies would be destroyed. It was a day when God would have God's way. It was a day when good would conquer evil. It was a day where, in the words of Isaiah and Micah and some of those prophets, where swords would be beaten into plowshares, where the lion will lie with the lamb, where there'd be peace and harmony, and life would be good, and it would be fair, and it would be just, and people would be able to live. That's the kind of day that's coming. But I think what Amos is implying is that actually, you don't want that. You don't want fairness, because that might mean you having to give something up. That might mean having to let go of this wealth and these riches and these comforts that you cling to, which in and of themselves, there's nothing wrong with. But they've become your God. They've become your idol. They have become your religion. And you're not going to want to let go of those things. So you say, oh, bring on the day of the Lord. But actually, you don't really want to know about that, because that's not going to be the kind of day you imagine it to be. All right. So again, there's this deep-seated complacency. And if we're reading Amos in the spirit of openness ourselves, we've got to ask ourselves that question. To what degree have we become complacent or arrogant, even without knowing it, in such a way that it's blinded us to certain things? We're just going to explore that again in a little bit in a moment, and some of the questions in the study this week get at that. Now, back in chapter 5, there's some responses. There's a way through this. Amos puts out, look, there's a way you can respond that is different, and it's all around this issue of seeking God. So we'll see in chapter 5 this call to seek God and live. Maybe we can put the first one of those up. He particularly homes in on three cities, three locations, where there were shrines for the Israel religion. That's Gilgal, Bethel, and Beersheba. So we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that one. If we could go to chapter 5, I think it's verse 6. Four and five, nearly. This is what the Lord says to the house of Israel. Seek me and live. Do not seek Bethel. Do not go to Gilgal. Do not journey to Beersheba. For Gilgal will surely go into exile, and Bethel will be reduced to nothing. Okay, so we could just keep that up for the moment. We don't really see this in the way it's written on the screen there, but there's what's called a chiasm there. Okay, it's a poetic form. So seek me and live. Do not seek Bethel, Gilgal, Beersheba, Gilgal, Bethel. Okay, so there's a kind of like it's a shape to the language, and it's homing in. It's drawing our attention, in other words, to these three locations. They are shrines in the Israel religion. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that the whole of this section we're talking about here are messages from Amos to each of these shrines, where he's basically condemning their religious practice. He's saying, and we're going to look at some of the strong language in a moment that he has for the religious people. But these places of Gilgal, Bethel, and Beersheba are significant locations, and he kind of takes them on. Maybe he went to each of those places and gave a speech. We don't really know. But he's essentially saying, seek me and live. Don't seek those shrines. In other words, that religion is corrupt. Religion has led you astray. Religion's just lulled you into this false sense of security. Religion has replaced God. Seek God. Seek me. Seek intimacy. Seek connection to God. Seek connection to the real thing. Seek me and live, and don't go to those places. Okay, so that'll be a little bit like me saying, seek God, connect with God. God, don't come to Cedar Ridge. Now, I hope I don't have to say that, because hopefully what we're doing at Cedar Ridge is trying to seek God. But there's always a chance that we're just getting, you know, we're getting very impressed with ourselves and our own religion, and we're kind of chasing our tails. We've got to think about, are we really seeking God? To what degree do we really want God and the truth of God and the reality of God and the kind of challenge that God brings and the kind of challenge that we read about in Amos? Okay, now lots of seeking going on in chapter 5. Let's look at the next verse. Seek the Lord and live, or he will sweep through the house of Joseph like a fire. It will devour, and Bethel will have no one to quench it. So lots of seeking and imploring the people to seek God. There's another one right after this. Seek good, not evil, that you may live. Then the Lord God Almighty will be with you, just as you say he is. Hate evil, love good. Maintain justice in the courts. Perhaps the Lord God Almighty will have mercy on the remnant of Joseph. That word perhaps suggests, look, it's not inevitable. Okay, he ends the passage with saying that there's this power in the east, the Assyrian Empire in the 8th century BCE is going to swarm through this region, and it did. But he's saying, you know, look, if you seek God, if you seek good, if you're just, if you change your ways, this might not happen. There's an opportunity here. So what we have here is Amos taking on the religious establishment and really accusing them of being implicated in supporting and justifying all the military oppression, all the economic oppression. And it's interesting that he goes to the religious people and holds them accountable for what's going on in the culture. Okay, that should make our ears prick up. That we may not feel responsible for injustice, but as people of faith, we should be closely connected to it. We should have our ears and eyes open to injustice going on in our culture. Now, let's just back up a little bit to a statement that is made specifically to the Shrine of Gilgal. Okay, so if we could go on to the next one, it's in chapter 5 again. Okay, so Moses kind of ratchets up the vitriol here. He turns to the people, probably the priests, the people in the establishment. I despise your religious feasts. That's not a verse that gets quoted a lot in church, you know, surprisingly. I cannot stand your assemblies, neither that one. Even though you bring me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. Though you bring choice fellowship offerings, I have no regard for them. Away with the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the music of your harps, but let justice roll on like a river and righteousness like a never-failing stream. Now, I mentioned something about this in the first week. There's some significance buried away in this from the Hebrew language that we miss in the English translation. And this is almost certainly directed to Gilgal, okay, the shrine at Gilgal. And the reason we could say that is the word for roll, okay, let justice roll. Do you remember Martin Luther King quoted that, you know, in his famous I Have a Dream speech? But when we say let justice roll, the Hebrew word for roll is galal, okay? It sounds like Gilgal, and that's no coincidence because Gilgal was named Gilgal, and you can read about this in Joshua. It's like chapter 5, something like that. The Hebrew people, when they crossed the Jordan, they stopped at a place, and they called it Gilgal. And the reason they called it Gilgal was because coming across the Jordan represented final freedom from the people of Egypt. Okay, they'd been enslaved in Egypt. They escaped from Egypt with Moses. They wandered around in the desert for 40-odd years. And then they crossed the Jordan and finally got into what they believed to be the promised land, right? A whole bunch of stuff happened then. But anyway, they get across the Jordan, and they sort of build an altar. And God says, name this place Gilgal because I have rolled away the oppression of Egypt. I've rolled away. So in other words, when Amos says, let justice roll, what he's saying is, Gilgal, you of all places should be about justice because you're named after the very event in our history that kind of epitomizes justice. We were set free from enslavement. And yet now you, the ones who were once oppressed, have become the oppressors. And if religion isn't about setting people free, if it's not about justice, if it's not about mercy, then what is it about at all? And in fact, all the other trappings you have make me sick. I mean, if you read some renditions of this, it says that the religious acts are like a stench. The inference is they're like dead matter that's decaying and just stinks. Very strong language. So Amos is saying, seek me, but seek the real thing. Don't just seek religion, seek me, seek a reality. And then he sort of connects it even more strongly, I think, this seeking, to the issue of justice. If we go back to chapter 4, he said, so we're all still in this section. We'll just skip this a little bit here. Is this chapter 4? Yeah, okay, so we'll do this. Go to Bethel and sin. Go to church and sin. Go to Gilgal and sin yet more. Bring your sacrifices every morning, your tithes every 3 years. Burn leavened bread as a thank offering and brag about your free will offerings. Boast about them, you Israelites, for this is what you love to do, declares the sovereign Lord. Okay, then he goes on. So that's one statement. Then he follows up with this. I gave you empty stomachs in every city and lack of bread in every town, yet you have not returned to me, declares the Lord. So the juxtaposition of these two pieces here, right side by side, and then these two verses are followed by a sequence of other things that God says, I gave you all kinds of needs in your culture to wake you up, but you just ignored them. And this particular one, he's saying, I gave you empty stomachs. In other words, I gave you poverty. I gave you hunger. I gave you people in your culture who couldn't get enough to eat. And that was meant to return you to me. That was meant to make you think, oh, then something's wrong. But rather than you thinking that there's something wrong, you've just totally ignored it. So there's this connection, close connection between how we respond to injustice and whether we're alive or not spiritually. There's a very close connection to justice and true religion. James, we studied James a year or so ago, picks up on this theme and emphasizes this theme where in the book of James, in the New Testament, in the Christian scriptures, James says, true religion is looking after widows and orphans. It's caring for those in need. That's what true religion is about. If you want to see pure religion, that's where you see it. And so Amos is 800 or so years before James, is saying the same thing. And so there's this pointing to needs in society as opportunities, gifts, if you like, to wake us up. Now, just hit the pause button for a second there, okay? So we've jumped around in this section, and we've explored these themes of complacency and arrogance and empty religion and what real religion means, what real spirituality is. So let's just think for a moment about how we might apply some of these things to our own lives. And the discussion questions get into this, okay, this week. And as I've said before, I don't want to stand here and tell you how you should apply what Amos is saying. I mean, we've all got to wrestle with this, determine what we think it means, and then determine what we think our response should be, all right? And we're all going to be on slightly different pages there, and that's okay. What we can't do is just ignore it. What we shouldn't do is have an explanation that just doesn't make sense, and just sort of a dismissive kind of explanation. So let's just wrestle with it. But here's some of the ways in which I'm wrestling with this personally, okay? So here's some of the things that kind of stirs up in me. First one is this, I've got three specific things, but some sort of generalities are, one, religious people are held very accountable, right? Amos is not homing in on politicians or soldiers or, economic tycoons and all that kind of stuff. He's homing in on shrines and religious people and the religious establishment. In other words, we have some accountability, at least, for injustice in our society. Doesn't mean we're necessarily the perpetrators, but what are we doing to struggle for a fairer society, to struggle for justice? Okay, so that's one thing that makes me think, whoa, I better wake up to that. Second thing is this. Seems that if we have a certain amount of wealth, a certain amount of comfort, a certain amount of sort of success in our lives, it's very easy to become complacent. It's very easy to become blind to things. So I'm thinking, man, why do I think I'm different? Why should I be different as somebody who actually, relative to the rest of the world and relative to most people in North America, am pretty wealthy, pretty comfortable, and maybe not successful, but who defines that? But you know what I mean, right? So we would be kind of foolish to think that we couldn't be hoodwinked, that we couldn't be blinded to certain things, right? So the other thing here is, and I think this is a more subtle thing, is that throughout Amos attacks systems. He doesn't really get that personal. There's a personal encounter with a priest called Amaziah, and that we're going to hear about that next week. But he's talking about justice in the courts, and he's talking about economics, and he's talking about groups of people and systems that have become unfair. And so again, I feel like, man, I need to wake up to the thought that I may not be a specific personal individual perpetrator of injustice, but I might be caught up in systems that benefit me, but that don't benefit other people. Okay, and again, doesn't mean that's necessarily true. I just need to be aware that that might be true, and I might not see it. I might not be aware of it. It would be an easy thing to miss. Like if I walk down the street, grab somebody by the throat, and start beating them to a pulp, that's me being unjust. Right, but I could be part of a system an economic system, maybe even part of a military system that keeps me very comfortable and keeps me wealthy, but isn't so helpful to some other people, right? And I might not even be aware of it. Now, how might we apply some of these things? Let's think of this for the moment. Firstly, so I guess I want to put these out as challenges, and I think they're all pretty challenging challenges. One or two of them might make you really angry at me. Right? I'm just going to prepare you now. And one of them might get my green card taken away. You know, that's another thing. But let me mention this. To what degree? So these are questions. Three questions. To what degree have we been lured into the chase after wealth and comfort and security? I mean, to what degree are we seeking after God and seeking after reality and seeking after justice versus to what degree are we actually, our goals are really about our own self-satisfaction and our own comfort, our own security. So things like our jobs and our income and our education and the houses we live in and the cars we drive, etc., etc. Now, that's not a new thing. We talk about that a lot here. And there is nothing wrong with those things. There's nothing wrong with being wealthy. You know, most of us in this room would classify as pretty wealthy. I mean, we may not consider ourselves that way, but most of us relatively are. There's nothing wrong with being wealthy. The problem is when that becomes our goal, when that becomes our idol, when that consumes our activity and consumes our intention. And I think in our culture, it's held out there as that's the goal, right? I mean, there's this thing called the American dream, and it's not unique to America. It's, you know, it's the Western world. We aspire to a certain level of material comfort that we think is going to satisfy us. But it can lure us into a pursuit of things that ultimately are not satisfying, and that even blind us and make us complacent and kind of indolent towards other things that really do matter. Okay, so that's one question. To what degree is that going on? I think if we read Amos, I don't think we can escape that question. We've all got to answer that for ourselves. I'm trying to answer that for me, not for you. Second one is this. To what degree have we really woken up, or perhaps even put it another way, to what degree are we asleep and ignorant and perhaps unaware of the needs of the poor? The needs of the oppressed, the cry of the oppressed, and in what ways do we kind of work around those things to kind of make ourselves feel better and to justify ourselves? Let me give you an example of this. You know, we've been, as part of this series, we've been looking at the issue of racial injustice in our society. We talked a little bit about that last week, and there's some questions that get at that again this week in the discussion material. Let me just read a quote here, which from Martin Luther King, which I think is similar to that quote from Amos, where he says, "I gave you empty stomachs in every town, but you didn't return to me." Here's what Martin Luther King said back in the 60s, obviously, about a situation where there was some rioting. He says, now Martin Luther King's nonviolent. He's about nonviolence. Okay, so he says, "It is not enough for me to stand before you tonight and condemn riots." Okay, I think he is saying violence is wrong, but he's saying it's not enough just to say that the riots are wrong. It would be morally irresponsible for me to do that without at the same time condemning the contingent intolerable conditions that exist in our society. These conditions are the things that cause individuals to feel that they have no other alternative than to engage in violent rebellions to get attention. And I must say tonight that a riot is the language of the unheard. Now, let's think about this a little bit in the light of what we've been reading in Amos. Amos is saying, I gave you hungry stomachs in every town, empty stomachs in every town, but you didn't return to me. It's very easy for us to explain away when people cry out. Right? I think when people cry out and say, we're being oppressed, and I don't think anybody would say in our culture that, well, maybe some people would, but I don't think anybody really would say African-American people in this culture have not been oppressed, okay? They may disagree about oppression right now, but there's a history of oppression there that I think everybody would agree with. It started with slavery, and it's continued on in different forms, and different people have worked really hard against that, okay? But if people are crying out and saying, we're oppressed, we're feeling systems oppress us, I think Amos is saying the onus is not on the poor to behave themselves. The onus is not on the poor to shut up and behave in an orderly manner. The onus is not on particular groups of people to be civil and apologetic and polite about it and be grateful for all the great things that have happened. The onus is on the powerful. The onus is on the people who have privilege to stop and listen. Just to listen. Not necessarily even to agree, because we've got to listen before we can know whether we agree or not. But to listen with an open mind and a willingness to accept that maybe the other person is right. Or can we listen to the pain? Can we listen to the oppression? So we've got to ask ourselves, how do we respond when people cry out? Do we find ourselves wanting to go into defense mode and explain things away and say, well, that's not true. You can't say that about everybody. Not every, you know, when we come to the issue of race, and I'm going to talk in clumsy terms, forgive me, but we might want to say, well, not every white person is like that, and I'm not racist. Maybe that's not the issue. Could we just listen to the pain? And could we just listen to what people might have to say? And in the discussion questions, as you began last week, there's this opportunity for us, there's an exercise in there, to find somebody who's a different race to us, somebody of color who this applies to people of color too, to sit down and talk with somebody who's different and hear their perspective and listen. And maybe as a result of that, begin to wake up to some things that we've not been really awake to. Now that's, hopefully that's not too controversial to listen. But I think what we so quickly do is go to the place of excusing. And we can come up with all manner of excuses. But when we think about a historical situation where there's been so much pain, so much suffering, wouldn't we be sensitized to say, man, we are the ones that need to listen. We are the ones that are going to reach out. We're the ones that are going to go the extra mile in order for anything like the kind of future that the prophets talk about, the kind of future that people like Martin Luther King dreamed of, to become a reality. That's what it's going to take. Now, the third thing, gets at something else that we might think about, because we might have become complacent or kind of just caught up in comfort and strength and security and lulled into actually a false sense of security. Because let's remind ourselves, all these people who felt so comfortable eventually were overrun by a foreign empire, so they weren't that safe. But let's think about this from a national point of view. Okay, and I talked last week a little bit about, I'm from Great Britain, I'm British. And we had a massive great empire, right, up until not too long ago. In fact, people said the sun never sets on the British Empire. And we did not walk around thinking we are just mean, horrible people with a great big empire, and we're going to take your land, and we're going to take your money. We didn't walk around thinking we were mean. We didn't walk around thinking that we were dictatorial despots, all right? As I said last week, we walk around thinking we're nice, polite British people. We're very civil, and we have that reputation. But how did we acquire a massive, great empire? How did we end up controlling all the areas that we did? We did it, believe it or not because we wanted to just bless everybody around the world with our Britishness, right? We went because we wanted their stuff. Like, we didn't come to North America and stick a flag in the ground and say, this is ours now, and oh, you were here first. Well, you move off over there. And, you know, we didn't do that because we were trying to be kind. We did it basically because we wanted stuff. We wanted money. We wanted control. We certainly didn't want the French to get it or the Spanish, you know, a bit of jealousy. We did it for bad reasons, okay? We just got to face it. It was selfishness. It was like, we can have it. Let's go get it. We've got power. We've got strength. We can control things. And hey, here's another genius idea. We can begin to work the land, but we won't do a spot of work ourselves. We'll go and capture a whole load of other people and get them to work for free. And then we'll build up even more wealth that way. Okay? We did that kind of thing. And not, we didn't just do it in North America. We did it all over the place. We did it in India. We did it all around the world. And I know I'm sounding, you know, like I'm not very patriotic. I'm very patriotic. I love England. I love the country I come from. I'm you know, if you see me watching England play rugby or football or soccer or cricket or whatever, you'll see that I'm very patriotic. And I think we've done a lot of good things in the world. A lot of great things have come out of England. But the main motivation behind Empire was not a good motivation. Now, I want to read for you a couple of songs that we have. And you've probably heard of these songs, right? So the first one is, where's my glasses? And I want to show this, the close association or the subtle association of religion, potentially religion with empire. All empires kind of get religion on their side. Religion, economics, and the military, the things we've read about in Amos, that in empire situations, they tend to support one another and come together. Now, has anybody heard of the song Jerusalem? It's a song, words of William Blake. Okay, great romantic poet. I love William Blake. Fantastic guy. And I love this poem, actually, and it's a song that's sung, but it's a song that gets misinterpreted, and you can see how it was used in the British Empire. Here it goes. And did those feet in ancient time, referring to Jesus, walk upon England's mountains green? And was the holy Lamb of God on England's pleasant pastures seen? Now, I think that Blake is meaning this metaphorically, okay? But there's a tendency to think, like, we're the chosen people. We're the promised land. Like, Jesus came to England. Wait a minute. So, I mean, Jesus probably went to a load of places that aren't recorded in the Bible, but there's no real evidence that Jesus came to England, okay? And did the countenance divine shine forth upon our clouded hills? And was Jerusalem builded here among these dark satanic mills? Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear, O clouds unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental flight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land. Right? Metaphorically, beautiful. If we take that at least a tad literally, we're in all kinds of trouble. And you can see how songs like this can build towards a sense of who we are and the righteousness of our empire and the righteousness of our way of life. Well, here's another one, Land of Hope and Glory. Anybody know Land of Hope and Glory? I think you sing the same tune. It's Elgar's Pomp and Circumstance. You sing it different words to it. But I'm just going to read you the chorus to this very popular song, still really in England. And it was sung a lot in the Second World War. Sort of patriotic song, and it's kind of like the English national anthem. God Save the Queen is the British national anthem. This is really the English national anthem. I'm just going to read you this chorus. Land of hope and glory, mother of the free. You may be the land of the free. We're the mother of the free. Okay, so mother of something, anyway. Land of hope and glory, mother of the free. How shall we extol thee who were born of thee? That's people like me. Wider still and wider shall thy bounds be set. God who made thee mighty, make thee mightier yet. And if I read you some of the verses, it gets even worse. It's basically saying, we're mighty. God is with us. God is supporting our empire. God is on our side. And it's very easy when we're in a position of power to assume that God is on our side. It's very easy for us to assume that we're not bad people. We're good people. We kind of hide away the things that we do badly. And we promote the things that we do. We do the good that we do. Now, let me give you another example. Actually, I think we've got these as quotes. So we have some like Winston Churchill. Okay, great guy. Wonderful guy. Heroic leader in the Second World War. Here's some of the things that Churchill said about a couple of situations prior to the Second World War. Early on, this is in the time when Gandhi was campaigning non-violently for the English just to let the Indians have India back. You know, which seems like a fair thing to do. And he was doing it non-violently. Here's what Churchill said about Gandhi. It is alarming and also nauseating to see Mr. Gandhi, a seditious Middle Temple lawyer of the type well known in the East, now posing as a fakir striding half-naked up the steps of the Viceregal Palace to parley on equal terms with the representative of the King Emperor. I mean, how dare he see himself as on the equal terms as the King Emperor, you know, because the King of England was known as the Emperor of the Empire. That's chauvinistic to the extreme, right? I mean, that's so biased. I mean, it's so prejudiced. Here's what Churchill said about the use of chemical weapons or mustard gas during the Arab revolt in the early part of the 20th century. I do not understand this squeamishness about the use of gas. I'm strongly in favor of using poisonous gas against uncivilized tribes. I mean, one of the reasons the West invaded Iraq was because there was at least a notion of that Saddam Hussein had used poisonous gas on the Kurds, right? That was one, I mean, we won't get into all that today, but you know, you know, there's, I mean, uncivilized tribes, that sounds uncivilized to me, right? Now, again, I'm not being unpatriotic, all right? But I'm just saying that as a nation, we've had to come to terms with the fact that actually, we got too big for our boots. Actually, a lot of our rhetoric and a lot of the mythology of our empire was not true, not real. We overextended ourselves. Empires crumble because violence begets violence. Hate begets hate. And so they're ultimately self-destructive. Now, let me ask you this question as Americans, as patriotic Americans. And this is the one that may cost me my green card, okay? So please don't report me anywhere. But could we at least ask ourselves that question, that maybe as participants in a very successful, wealthy, powerful nation, our military strength and safety and security, our economic strength and safety and security, both of which obviously have recently been felt more fragile, right, and disturbingly so, could be tied up with our religion and almost being American becomes the religion rather than seeking God. Right? Now, again, I love this country. I'm really grateful that you're allowing me to live here. I'm just saying this as someone who's from another country that has kind of struggled with these things. To what degree do we look at the world through the lens of our nationality and all the trappings of that, or through the lens of a compassionate God who sees and hears the cry of the poor? And to what degree are we prepared maybe to give up some control that keeps that wealth and security in order that some other people might have some benefits? And I know this is a complex issue. We're going to try and explore some of those issues in the next few weeks. I'm not in any sense meaning that there's easy answers. But to what degree are we prepared to speak out and face the fact that we might be unjust? You know, when stories come out about torture, right, I think we quickly go to explaining things away, or we can do, rather than saying, we need to repent of that. Like when people like Churchill say those kind of things, I've got to say, that's wrong. That's just wrong. Thank you for your leadership and all the other things you did. I'm not going to say you're a horrible person. It's just that attitude is wrong. The system that has fed is just wrong. And in the same way, I think we can, in our politics, in our economics, in the way we view the world, we can get caught up in something where we're not prepared to criticize ourselves. We're not prepared to face the fact that we need a change, that we're not necessarily as good as we would like to think we are. We maybe need to stop believing our own mythology, because that's what these people were doing back in Amos's day. They were longing for the day of the Lord because everything's great. Come and judge, God. Come and judge, because we're the good guys. And we've explained away all the other things. But he's saying, no, I gave you hunger in every town, and still you have not returned to me. So I know what I'm saying is controversial. I'm not trying to point the finger. I'm not trying to say how you should respond to this, how anyone should respond. But could we at least ask ourselves those questions and let these things be stirred up in some of the conversations we have in the group and some of the discussions that we have together? We're going to have communion now, and I'm just going to pray, and then Brandy's going to come and lead us in communion, and she's going to just share a few words of her own as well. So let's just pray. Lord Jesus, we come to you as God of compassion, God of tenderness,